Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Grammy and ASCAP award-winning American producer, songwriter, DJ, and recording artist Damon Sharp is best known for his creativity behind the scenes. Lately, Damon has also been focusing on releasing his own music, which is allowing the transition from the behind the scenes to being in front of them. Furthermore, on the DJ front, Damon has been playing live sets worldwide, including EDC Vegas and SXSW. Damon has contributed many recognizable songs to popular culture and has been involved with the production of various popular albums that cumulatively have sold over 45 million copies. He has worked with the likes of Jennifer Lopez, Ariana Grande, Pitbull, Alesso, Kelly Rowland, Kylie Minogue, Big Time Rush, New Kids on the Block, the Pitch Perfect soundtrack, the Grammy Award-winning Chicago soundtrack, Natalie Cole, Johnny Gill, New Edition, amongst many others. Amongst Damon's catalogue of original releases are four tracks with Armada Records: the highly acclaimed Fire and Gold with Morgan Page and Vivid, which peaked at number 7 on the US dance radio charts; When in Rome with Gattuso, which peaked at number 6 on the US dance radio charts and gained over 50 million Spotify streams; Ghost Ship featuring Ojan Nielsen; and Lifetime with Zonderling and Josh Cumby, now with over 16 million Spotify streams. The tracks made a dent in the Sirius BPM, Sirius Chill, iHeart Evolution, Music Choice rotations, and received support from the likes of Don Diablo, Lucas and Steve, Hardwell, David Guetta, Martin Garrix, and many more. His songs have been featured in many feature films, television shows, and commercials around the world. As an artist, he has reached over 74 million streams and 1.7 million monthly listeners on Spotify. He has achieved nearly 2 billion streams as a producer, songwriter, and artist combined. Up next on Celeb Savant, we've got Damon Sharp. Where in the world are you and how are you doing?
Yes, well, thanks again for having me, Barrett. I am actually here in Los Angeles, California. I'm about 5 minutes literally away from what we call the Burbank Airport, which is kind of like our local airport, which is the preferred one if you're flying within the U.S., just because it's a lot easier to get through security. But yeah, I'm here. I'm actually at my recording studio today. I live in Santa Clarita, which is about 30 minutes north. But I'm here in my my stomping grounds in my studio right now.
So I've been to L.A. and when I've driven in the traffic in L.A. and 30 kilometers, it sounds easy, but I'm sure it's a long drive if there's lots of traffic. Am I correct?
Yes. I mean, I'm lucky because, like I said, I kind of live in the burbs and then I travel down. But I have friends that will literally go, I'm not sure what it is in kilometers, but literally a distance of 2 miles and it could take you 40 minutes. It's just insane. You know what I mean? It's definitely crazy.
So I remember when I was visiting, I was staying with family in Irvine, and then I was going to meet or visit a friend in West Hollywood. And I remember them saying that I need to leave it around 2:30 to get there by 6, because if I leave after 2:30, I'll be in the traffic for 8 hours. And I was like, aren't they crazy? Yep. But it was actually exactly that. I left at 2 and I got there at 6.
Oof. Yeah, it's pretty insane.
Okay, so Damon, let's rewind. At what age did you think, cool, you want to be in this creative production music world? And how did that journey progress to where we are today?
Yeah, well, hopefully we have the time. I'll give you the long instead of the short, because it's pretty fun. It's a crazy journey. So I actually, probably around age, I was maybe like 12 or 13, I started seeing all these movies with, you know, dance and singing. And I remember seeing the movie Breakin' as a kid, and I was like, ooh, I want to do that. You know, I have something about what they were doing. It was the dancing, it was the music, it was just everything kind of sucked me in to that world. And I started taking breakdance lessons. And while I was there, I, you know, the teacher came over and was like kind of watching people in the class. And I kind of noticed someone's watching me. And after the class, she came up to me. She's like, oh, you're doing really good in there. She's like, would you be interested in doing jazz dancing? I was like, I don't know. I don't really know much about it, you know? So she goes, come here. And she grabbed my hand and she walked me over to the, you know, to the other window where you could watch the other class.
Yeah.
And she's like, if you do this, you get to meet all those girls in there. And I was like, I'm in. So I started jazz dancing as well. So I started doing competitive dance for about, gosh, almost 2, 3 years, probably up until about the age 15. I was coming back and forth to LA, New York, competing in all these different dance conventions, right? So as I did that, my teacher at the time was plugging me into people out here in LA, agents, things like that. And I started booking very much smaller jobs, but I remember I booked like a Levi's industrial, which basically is part of what's called the magic show that they do in Vegas, where it's like all the big designers come and they do these massive shows with dancers. And so I was one of the dancers in that show. So that kind of dipped my feet in. So I think summer of that year, I went to my parents and I was like, this is, I'm 15 at this point. I'm like, look, I want to move to LA. I want to do my, and they're like, you're only 15, but you know what? We'll go there for a summer and try it. So I was like, oh, amazing. Thank you so much. So we came out literally within the first few weeks. I booked like a Disneyland commercial, then I book a Pepsi commercial, then I book a Nintendo commercial. So it all started snowballing. And my parents were both teachers. So as that summer progressed, they're like, you know what? We'll start looking. We'll move out there so you can pursue your dream. So I owe everything to them, right? So we moved out, and pretty quickly again, I booked my first tour as a backup dancer. I'm out on the road at 15 with three other 15-year-old dancers and one legal guardian. So you can imagine how crazy that was. That was kind of like my high school friends, whatever, pre-college experience, right? So we had a blast. I came back. Again, within a few months, I was just auditioning, booking work. And I've got very fortunate. I booked a TV show called The Guys Next Door. Now, this was on NBC only for about a season. It was on for about a year and a half after Saved by the Bell, if you remember the Saturday morning show, Saved by the Bell. So we were on after that. We also had a record deal with EMI Records. So really quickly, at this point, I'm maybe 16. So I'm about to be 17, and I'm already having a record deal, a TV show. We blow up overnight. Like literally, when I say overnight, it's like we had board games, dolls, sleeping bags, pajamas, on the cover of teen magazines, to literally fast forward a year and a half later, at the end of that, the show is canceled, the record deal's repealed, I'm on unemployment again, because at that point I was like, I didn't really want to take money from my parents. I was like, I'm gonna make my own way, right? And I'm still at this point maybe 18, 19 max, right? But at that point, it's very hard when you're that age, right? Like this is what happens to a lot of quote unquote teen stars, and when they're younger, they burn out really fast, right? Because you get all this success and you start to believe the hype. And then if it gets taken away, unfortunately, some people, it affects their mental health. They turn to addiction, or they just say, hey, I'm not good enough, and they just bow out. So for me, I think I did go through probably a good, maybe almost 2 full years of what I call the dark years, where I was just believing the voices that people were coming at me and the negative things. And honestly, I don't really know what the epiphany moment was. At some point, I was just like, what are you doing? Like, suck it up, And at that point, I went back to school for music. I was taking acting again. I got a new agent. Any penny I made waiting tables was literally put into me, for the studio. So here's the crazy part. So when I say we blew up, right? We were out doing what are called the upfronts, right, for our TV show, which I'm sure you know what they are. It's like you go and you take all the other TV shows are there, and you're doing press. So we're literally at upfronts doing photos with Will Smith as a peer. And then fast forward 2 years later, I'm waiting tables serving Will Smith a Pepsi. So it was like an incredible, crazy life lesson, right? He was also he was the kindest person about it. He was not weird about it at all. Like he remembered us. It was me and my best friend Patrick from the show. So we were both working in the same place. It was so crazy. But yeah, so like I said, as I sucked it up, I started doing the work again. And you know how it is. Once you do the work, this is what I always tell people whenever I go in on podcasts or speak at conferences or whatever. If you do the work, something will come out of it. It may not be exactly what you were looking for, but something will come out of it if you put in the work, right? So literally, I just start banging away. I started booking TV shows again. I started a new project as an artist, as a solo singer. And then I got basically cast in yet another boy band, right? And I spent literally 3 years of my life in this boy band. And we went from originally we were signed to A&M Records, which is now defunct. Then we were signed to Epic. Then for the third deal in year three, we were supposed to sign to Warner Brothers. And I remember being on that conference call, and they're like, hey, everybody's gonna get a $20,000 advance, and it's gonna be this and it's gonna be that. And I was like, oh my God, I need this money so bad. But something in my heart was like, this isn't right. I've spent 3 years doing this. I don't want to do another boy band chapter. I've already done this multiple times. So I passed. And I remember hanging up the phone going, oh my God, what did I just do? So I'm again back on unemployment, broke again, right? Trying to figure out what I'm gonna do. But again, I just started doing the work again. I just kind of tried to put it behind me and keep it moving, right? As hard as it was, right? So at that point, probably a few months go by, and I get a call from a gentleman who ended up becoming my mentor. His name is Rick Wake. He was actually the head who signed the boy band, right? That was signed for 3 years. And let me rewind. The funny part is, get the name of the group became a self-fulfilling prophecy. The name of the group was Unheard Of. So it literally, like, was
What kind of a name is that? Just bizarre.
exactly. That was one of the members in the band. We let him come up, David, and it was a cool name. And it was all like misspelled UNHURDUV. And anyway, but yeah, it just became a self-fulfilling prophecy. So, but the silver lining there was, Rick was kind of our mentor, and a gentleman by the name of Claude Brooks, who I owe so much to as well. I get a call from Rick, who really over those 3 years, I maybe had seen him 10 times. Like he was kind of overseeing it and funding it, but he had all his producers and writers at the time kind of grooming us and helping us in the studio. And so I was that obnoxious kid over all their shoulders. Oh, what are you doing? How did you write that song? Oh, give me some production tips. I was just annoying them so much. But it allowed me for 3 years to learn literally from the best, right? So I started writing a lot of my own material. So I had left a CD of songs on his publisher's desk, and that's what he called me about. He's like, I found this CD. He's like, did you write these songs? There were four songs in there. And I was like, yeah, I've been trying to tell you, for 3 years, I'm not just a boy band kid. I really want to produce and write. And he's like, all right, well, you should come. He's like, come work with me. It's going to be a whole different situation. And I was like, I don't know, Rick. I was like, it's 3 years of my life. And, he's like, okay, no pressure. He's like, let me go pitch these songs and I'll get back to you. So I'm like, okay, great. Awesome. Bye, click. Again, I don't really understand the gravity of how much that meant at the time, right? So about a month goes by and I get a random call from Rick again. And he's like, oh, I got two of your songs placed. And I'm like, cool. Like, okay, what does that mean? Right. And he's like, do you know who Anastasia is? And I was like, I don't. And he goes, she's blowing up internationally. She wants to do your song, Love Don't Cost a Thing. I'm like, oh, this is great. He goes, do you know Jennifer Lopez? I was like, oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, she wasn't J-Lo yet, but she already had like Waiting for Tonight, My Love, all that sort of stuff. Let's Get Loud. So I was like, oh my God, yeah, I love her. And he's like, she wants to do your song, Why'd You Lie to Me? So I'm like, oh, great, this is amazing. And he's like, all right, well, I'll get back to you. Click, hang up. Month or two goes by. Again, I forget about it, right? So I get a second call, but not from Rick. This is from one of my very good friends who was interning at a label. And she's like, Damon, did you do a song for Jennifer Lopez? And I'm like, I think maybe. And she's like, do me a favor, like, go to the newsstand right now, pick up R&R magazine and look at the back. I'm like, what is R&R? She goes, just go to the newsstand. So I speed to the newsstand. I'm like, where's R&R? And I go over there and I pick it up and I flip it over. I'm like, oh my God, it says, it's Jennifer Lopez, the iconic shot of her midriff. And it says, Love Don't Cost a Thing, and Sharp, Greg Lawson, and my co-writers. I'm like, holy crap. So I call Rick, and Rick's like, yeah. He's like, I didn't want to jinx it. He goes, it literally went from exchanged hands, right? It went from Anastasia doing it to Anastasia doing Lie to Me and Jennifer doing Love Don't Cost a Thing to Jennifer not wanting it, to wanting it, to it being on the album, to becoming the single in a matter of like 10 days. So it's already shipped off to radio. And then at that point, Rick's like, now will you come work with me? And I'm like, of course. And you know what happens at that point, right? Then when people start catching wind, all the people that didn't want to work with me, right, are now coming out of the woodwork. Oh, Damon, it's so and so from DreamWorks. You gotta come work with me, man. It's gonna be great. And I'm like, thank you. I was still super kind about it. I kept it up my sleeve, but I was like, thank you, but I'm going with Rick because he had my back when nobody did, right? So within a week, I'm on a plane. I'm out there with Rick. We had an incredible like 8 year run. We worked with everybody from Celine, freaking, Monica, Maya, Chicago soundtrack we got the Grammy for. Like, it was just a crazy, like, almost 8 year run together. And then after that, he kind of dissolved his company. He had incredibly crushed it and had multiple Grammys and made so much money. He's like, you know what? I'm just bowing out. And he's still around. We're still good friends. But yeah, I owe so much to him. And then literally after that, I was like, okay, what do I want to do now? Right. So I'm like, all right, I've had some really great success, but I'm still. This only chapter two of my life, right? I have all these iterations. At that point, I kind of put together a girls group that I got signed to Island Def Jam. I went back in the studio with Anastasia to do more stuff at that point because I had so much success with her. And based on that, I got a new deal with EMI, which turned into Sony ATV. And I was over there for a good 5 years and worked on everything from Big Time Rush to Nelly to Kylie Minogue to Alesso. So many great cuts with them. And then when that deal was up, then I ended up signing to a company out of Amsterdam, which is called Cloud9, which is essentially the sister company of Armada. If you know Armada, that's the label owned by Armin van Buuren, Perron, and David Lewis. So at that point, I had been doing a ton of dance music for all sorts of iconic DJs. So at that point, my attorney at the time was like, He's like, okay, you've been doing this, you've been doing that. He's like, you're doing all these records for DJs and you're doing a lot of the work and you're not getting any recognition for it. He's like, why is that? And I was like, I don't know. He goes, because you don't DJ anymore. Because I had always DJed when I was younger. So he's like, why don't you start DJing again? And then these can be your records as well. So literally something inspired me. I went out the next day, I bought brand new decks, I bought a brand new mixer. This is right before pre-pandemic. I hired a DJ mentor and learned the art of CDJs and mixing again. And for about a year of pandemic, I spent honing my skill set, obviously still producing and writing simultaneously, but this was kind of my passion. And now, fast forward 5 years later, I have, in addition to my 2 billion streams as a producer and a songwriter, an additional 100 million as a DJ and an artist. And I've played EDC Vegas. I just played it less than a month ago, South by Southwest, ADE. It's nuts. I mean, over the next few months, I'm headlining here in LA at Catch One. I'm also headlining in San Diego, and I'm headlining in, it's just in Phoenix. It's just insane. And so it's been this beautiful, like, iterations of multiple chapters now that, like, I always use this. So I don't know if you know the, I don't know if you guys had these in South Africa, but did you guys have the Hot Wheels tracks when you were a
Yes,
kid?
yes, 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 yes.
Okay. So I always tell people, like, I'm at a point in my life now where I'm kind of I have all those. I've got my DJ producer lane. I've got my songwriter lane. I've got my, label, which I just started, which is called Brain Jack. It's 2 years young, but we're about 73 releases in already. And then I have my family life. I've got my beautiful wife, my daughter. So it's insane. It's beautiful.
I love that story. You've inspired me. There are lots of messages for me to hear, which I was struggling with in the last couple of days. So thank you for that, but I'm not going to dive into that.
Awesome.
You've been in the
Please.
industry in multiple iterations for a number of years. So this is something I discuss a lot with people, and I'd like to hear your observation and perception.
Yeah, of course.
I love me a CD. I still budget for my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange for you guys, for all the hard work that you do. I love the
Yeah.
journey of the choice, the receiving, the unpacking, the booklets, the listening from
Yeah.
song one to the other. I'm sure you are aware of being in a label and so forth that CDs, even cassettes and vinyls are making massive comebacks all around the world. But then we've also got
Yep.
these streaming platforms that people consume music on. What is your
Yeah.
observations and perceptions of the landscape at the moment?
Well, it's interesting, right? So I of course, because of my generation that I come from, I love the tangibility of, like you said, a CD, a cassette, whatever it may be. And ironically, I do a lot of work in K-pop and J-pop, and they still sell tons of physical units, right? Because over there, they appreciate not only the tangibility, but the Japanese in particular and the Koreans, they understand how to package something, right? So the few times I've been over there, you'll go into like a three-story Tower Records that still exists in
Oh, wow.
Shibuya. Have a boy band like a BTS, and it'll be a package of like a CD, a T-shirt, maybe a glow stick or something. So they will appreciate the tangibility. And like you said, I also think it's an interesting generational thing, right? Because for me, I've seen multiple generations as well, and now I have a daughter who's a Gen Alpha. So it's interesting to see her consume in a very different way, right? For her, she's on the iPad, she's on her phone, and to her, she's just as excited, if not more excited, to get $100 worth of Robux for Roblox as opposed to me giving her tangible cash, right? So it's very interesting. I mean, and weirdly, it's a full circle thing because, and not to jump subjects, but I'm a little ADHD.
No, that's fine.
I was kind of very cynical about social media for a long time, right? And about 2 years ago, I had multiple people come around me and go, look, if you really want to do your DJ project or even just your production and songwriting, you have to have a social media presence, right? And at that time, I was fortunate. I was already verified on a few platforms just because of my past history, right? But not all the way across the board. So I said, you know what? Let me see what I can do here. Let me find something that, like, because it didn't make me happy previous, right? It felt like work. And I met this kid named Trenton, he was 18 at the time, he's 20 now. Been shooting my content and he just got it. He sat with me for an hour and he's like, dude, I know exactly what to do. And I was like, are you sure? He's like, Tr just trust me, just go with it. And like I said, I kind of pride myself on being a king of reinvention, right? I'm like, let's try it. Let's see what happens. Worst thing is I can fail. So I've spent the last 2 years building my numbers. I'm verified on every platform now, and it helps drive traffic not only to my music as a DJ and an artist, but also for me as a producer songwriter, right? And there might be a new young artist that sees me on there and goes, yeah, I like it. He's funny. I want to work with him. Like, I don't think we discount that a little, right? So I say that to say we have a crazy post that I put up 5 days ago just 5 days ago. And it's here at my studio. It's me and my daughter, and we're having a conversation about Gen Alpha slang, right? And it's how I would say it, or maybe how, like, probably how Gen X, Gen Z, and millennials would say it, and how Gen Alpha says it. And this video is at 52 million views in 5 days.
Wow.
And it's like almost 30,000 new followers to my account on Instagram. So it's crazy. So long story short, I think it all ties in together, right? Because it all
Yes.
has to do with technologies, new technologies, not giving up on the things that we love. Because if that is something that you enjoy, whether it's you're an audiophile, you love collecting vinyl, or you love collecting CDs, that's amazing. But we also, as especially you're a podcaster, you're successful at that, we also have to keep our eyes on the forefront of what's coming next, AI, things that are looming that we may not want to look at. But if we can get a little bit of all of those in our lives, like for me, like I said, I want those moments of the retro and the vintage. Like I when I played EDC, I'm in a freaking white Michael Jackson Thriller jacket, you know what I mean? Which is, I love it because that was my biggest inspiration, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a mixture of the old, the present, and where I want to go, if that makes sense.
Okay, so you've got the DJing, the songwriting, the producing, the record label. How do you balance out what's happening in your life? Or is it just okay, going with the flow and just letting it flow into your energy?
I would say that is my biggest dilemma, right? Is time management. It's really hard to know where to allocate my time. So I feel like 20 plus years later that I've been fortunate enough to be self-sustaining in this business and support my family. I think for me, it's ebb and flow. It's about understanding I can't go, okay, 2 days this week is just DJ, 3 days of just production songwriting, 2 days is the label, 2 days off. You know, there's not even that many days, but it's like what, I have 8 days. You know, at least a minimum of 1 or 2 days to spend with my family. Like, I think balance is it. And I always tell people, like, all the things I used to make fun of when I was younger, I do now. Meditation, I used to shit on meditation. I love meditation now. A gratitude list, I used to make fun of those. I love those now. I eat as clean as possible. I drink as minimal as I can. I work out 6, 7 days a week if I can. So it's really just, for me, it's balance. And like you said, in those career facilities, like I said, I always go back to my analogy of the Hot Wheels tracks, because they've all started to now merge into one lane where all these cars are kind of running in parallel. And I'm like, oh, you know what? I feel like jumping in that little Ford over there, which is my DJ. Let me jump in there for a few days. And you know what? While I'm there, I will probably meet some people who want me to produce and songwrite for them, or I can do a collaborative social media post with them. You know, there's just so many parallels. It's not like I'm you know, hey, I'm gonna be, you know, I'm gonna run a Fortune 500 company making brackets, and then I'm gonna be a DJ. It's there, those obviously aren't related at all, but everything I'm doing is somewhat related and parallel, right? So, and then I also still develop a few artists. It's just it's very limited who I do because it's so time consuming, and I'm so passionate about it. But that's also a smaller portion of my time where I have artists that I develop that I'm very passionate about, where I can quote unquote pass the baton and also use my network that I've built up over the past 20 something years and help them achieve what they want to achieve in their lives.
You're DJing. So when you DJ, is it your own original songs, remixes of other artists, and a combination of both of those? Or how do you choose what to play in your playlist?
Well, it's interesting. It's all of the above, right? And I always appreciated DJs, but just in the past 5 years, it's given me a completely different appreciation because I've always understood to a certain extent what I call the journey. You know, seeing someone like a Cascade play and it starts, and then you feel like you went on this journey of ups and downs, and by the time you're like, oh, I feel so good. So for me, I'm always trying to achieve that. So for example, when I prep for EDC, I prepped almost a month in advance, right? And I'm song selecting, and I already have played there twice, so I kind of know the energy, hopefully, that's going to happen, right? And I was playing a prime slot at like 2 a.m. on a Sunday, which sounds late, but that's actually prime because people doesn't start till 7 and people leave at 7 in the morning. So I kind of know the energy that I want to play, and I'll usually curate maybe 80 to 100, you know, songs that are, most of them are custom edits, as you said. Maybe 20% are my originals. Maybe another 25 to 30 are, you know, remixes, like, like a popular, you know, 2000 song or an 80s song, Outfield Love remixed, you know, something that I know is going to pop off, or Call on Me, Eric Prydz. Like, they're like the staple songs you know are going to go off. And no matter if you start to lose the crowd, you're like, let me switch. And then they're like, call on me, call me. And like, ah, they just start going nuts, right? So, yeah, that's kind of how I build them out. And it all depends on what I'm going to be playing. If I'm going to be playing a small, intimate, a party for friends, that's going to be a completely different set than if I'm playing, main stage, or if I'm playing even a club. Like when I play Phoenix next month, it's going to be a club called Almost Famous, which is it's like one of their only like true house clubs. So a lot of that will be a little more, for lack of a better word, cool kid kind of boiler room kind of house stuff mixed in with some more of the commercial, like a tech house flip of Holla Back Girl that I did, or I have a bass house flip of Young Jocks It's Going Down. That will definitely be in my set because I know it's one of those ones that millennials are going to go crazy for because that's from their golden years or whatever you want to call it.
Obviously, when you DJing, you have to be able to read the room, the energy of the crowd. Has production and producing for artists helped you build with that? And is that something that's come naturally for you? Is that something that you have to had to build into as you've done more DJ work?
Oh, I love, that's a great question. Nobody's ever asked that, and I love that question. I think one hand washes the other, right? So yes, I think because I come from production and songwriting, I DJ slightly different than someone would if they weren't a musician. But I will say this, over these past 5 years, I've learned so much by reading the room and watching and seeing what people react to. And that's changed the way that I produce for certain artists, right? It's like I kind of, it's constantly, obviously, I'm constantly learning, but now I understand a little better if I'm working with a specific artist and I know their motifs and I know what their sound is. I'm like, oh my God, I think I know what we can try here because this sort of thing resonated and it's similar to what you do, but we can take it to the next level. So yeah, I think reading the room, like you said, it's both. I think it helps that I have had a musician's background and a producer's background, but I think now being in front of them, it also just keeps me so much more relevant, right? Because the average person that's at a club is going to be 21 to 30, 35 probably is the average range. So that's the sweet spot of people that most artists are catering to. Not that it's not older and it's not younger, but I feel like that's the kind of sweet spot demo, right? So I'm getting a free litmus test when I'm playing a new, what we call IDs as DJs, something brand new. If people start reacting to it, I'm like, oh shit, there's something here. Okay, I need to flush this out. Let me make this better. Let me think when I release this, let me make sure this is a proper rollout and it's not just a soft release. So it's really cool. Even when I'm remixing other people's songs, it's the same thing. Like I'm like, okay, great. I'm doing a Flo Rida remix or whatever. And I'm like, all right, I already know the energy of the people that want to hear this. So I'm gonna cater that to them,
Okay, so moving back to producing and writing for other artists. First of all, for the listeners who do not understand, what does it mean to produce for someone?
Wow. So that's also a very interesting question that a lot of people don't understand. So traditionally, a producer in film or television is just kind of overseeing things, right? They're kind of making sure all the cogs are moving and they're hiring all the people that need to be there. A producer in the traditional sense was more of a Quincy Jones or a Rick Rubin, which again, they were kind of overseeing, not that they weren't competent. Like obviously Quincy Jones is an amazing musician, but as a producer, he'd say, I want Steve Lukather on guitars and I want Jeff Pecora on drums, or, and he's bringing in the best and he's overseeing it. And as Rick Rubin says, who's one of my, what's the word I'm looking for? Like idols as a producer, he's like, he's a tastemaker, right? So he's overseeing the process and he may not be playing the drums, but he damn well knows what he wants his snare to sound like. And he knows what he wants the kick to sound like. And he knows that the patterns should switch up on verse two. So there's multiple definitions of a producer in music. I feel like there's the traditional producer, which is more of the overseer, which obviously has to have the knowledge or it falls apart. And then there's people that I call, programmers or beat makers, which are a lot of the new hip hop generation where they are great at making a beat, but aren't even necessarily trained musicians, and some of them couldn't even write a vo you know couldn't even write a song to save their lives, but they're amazing at making beats. So they'll partner up, like Dr. Dre is incredible, he's a genius, but he would also bring in someone like a Scott Storch to play the keyboards because he was more of a drum guy. So a Timbaland, same thing. I mean, Timbaland plays everything as well, but he will also have an incredible keyboard player in the room with him. So he's overseeing it, he's programming, they're coming up with chord ideas, they put that together. Then a top liner traditionally will come in and write the lyric and melody, whether if the artist doesn't write their own song. Then at that point, they might even bring in an outside person to do the vocal production if they're not a singer. So some of them are amazing and can actually sing, like a Max Martin can sing it back and get them to sound amazing. But there's other producers I've worked with that would say to me, hey, Damon, can you, I need you in here, bro. I need you to like work because I was a singer. So they know that they can have someone in the room that understands, how to hit the notes and vocal production and stacking. So there's definitely, it's an insane art to it, but I digress. I guess my answer would be there's multiple types of producers okay. in the business.
So you've worked with a number of artists in all genres at and some of them more than once. So when you've gone into a room with an artist that you've never worked or collaborated with,
yes.
how do you approach that person or people if it's a group? And mm-hmm. is it a situation of, or is it different every time? Is it a situation of having a discussion, seeing where everyone's at, or how much input is it from them to you? What is that process of when you're interacting with someone that you haven't interacted with before?
Wow. Like you said, though, I don't want to take the easy out, but it is different in every okay. situation.
Right? So
for example, I just did a podcast maybe 2 weeks ago. It was a Kylie Minogue related podcast because I've done multiple songs for her. And, I think he was hoping that I was going to say she had all this input. And I was like, she just loved the song. You know, it was one of those songs that we had pitched and Britney Spears loved it. Pixie Lott loved it. She loved it. And we were just like, you know what? Kylie's the right fit for this. And luckily we did it because it ended up blowing up in like 60 countries or something. You know what I mean? It was a big hit. It was called Get Out of My Way. That was one of those ones where we went in and that was my first time meeting her. My co-producer and co-writer Cutfather has worked with her previous, but I had never met her. So I came in and I'm like, oh, and she's doing it. I'm like, oh, it sounds great. I was like, is there anything you want to change? She's like, oh, I know, I love it. I'm like, okay. And then after she does her leads, I'm like, you want to redo these backgrounds? She's like, I'll do some unisons, but I love the harmonies that are there. Let's keep them. You know what I mean? So it was just a very easy workflow and like such a humble person that just gets it, right? But then I've been in other situations where I've worked with artists and walked in and, you know, they'll remain nameless, but, you know, they're just difficult from beginning, you know,
yeah.
what ideas that you throw out they hate and their ideas are the best and the ego's in the room and, you know, just kind of roll with it. And, you know, then there's somewhere in the middle, which I actually probably is my favorite when there's an artist that comes in that has some ideas and is willing to challenge the process, but is also not going to be a jerk about it and go, you know what, best idea wins, let's roll with it. You know, so for me, it's kind of fun every time. And especially it doesn't matter if it's someone who's incredibly established or somebody who's brand new walking in the room. It's always an exciting process because, as you said, you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
So I always prefer, I don't like to just jump in and start working. I'd really love to meet up, have lunch, or we're here at the studio. Let's shoot the shit for a good hour. Let's get to know what we're all about. Let's get to know I want to know what they're going through right now, because sometimes that will spark the concept of the song just by having a conversation. And they say, oh, I just broke up with my boyfriend and this happened and that happened. And then boom, they say a keyword. I'm like, okay, let's go. You know what I mean? Or it will trigger, I don't know, whoever's in the room, if there's three of us collaborating, maybe we have a killer guitar player and immediately he starts playing some sort of a beautiful chord progression. And then the process just kicks off. So it's fun to me. Pretty much every time, you know, okay. The only time I don't have fun is when I'm stuck with a brief from a label that's so restrictive, right? Where they're like, this is a bad example, but BTS and it's this, and we want something just like Butter, and it has to be this tempo, and it has to be this.
Okay.
Now it feels like work, you know, it doesn't feel like I'm creating something. It feels like I'm copying something.
Okay.
You know, so for me, the creative process is so much fun. And I honestly, I love the business side as much as I love the creative side too. That's the ADHD in me, I think, you know?
Okay, so I love this game without any reasons, just top of mind. And I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 10 years, 20 minutes, I know your answer will be different every time, simply because there are millions of them.
Of course.
So if you had to push play to 5 songs by artists you've worked with or any artist, once you finish this conversation, what would those 5 songs be and by whom?
Oh my gosh, that is very tough. I mean, my probably 4 or 5 top artists are probably the childhood ones for me, right? Prince, Michael Jackson, George Michael, Stevie Wonder.
Okay.
Those immediately are my go-tos, right? And probably the albums that are associated, maybe not songs, but full bodies of work, Purple
That's
Rain,
fine.
Thriller, Off the Wall, Songs in the Key of Life. Oh, gosh, what? Listen Without Prejudice, Part 2. Like, there's just so many.
Yeah.
Between all those eyes, I can think of those would be my go-tos. If I was on a deserted island and I could only have, whatever, a handful of albums, those would probably be my go-tos,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, lovely.
Yeah.
So, Damon, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
Oh, wow. That is cool. Nobody's ever asked that. I would just say, you know what? If this is something that you want to do or whatever it is in your life that you choose to pursue, go for it. Like, you're going to get a million no's, but with every no, you're that much closer to a yes. And I've had so many doors slammed in my face. And you know what? I just find another door to go into on the outside. Or guess what? Kick the door in. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want anybody to ever look back and go, oh, I could have done this or I could have done that. Try it. Go for it. Worst you can do is fail. Like I said, you don't want to look back on your life and go, oh, I wish I would have done that. The other thing I'll say, a lot of people say, I want to be this and I want to be that. Don't say I want to, say I am, right? So if you want to be a songwriter, I'm a songwriter. I may not be successful yet, but I'm a songwriter. I'm a producer. I may not have a hit on the radio yet, but I'm a producer. So I think for some reason, especially in America, there's a lot of cynical people that kind of don't want to see you be successful, if that makes sense, unfortunately. And I try not to, I don't surround myself with those toxic people, right? I surround myself with positivity. But yeah, I think just surrounding you with the right people and just staying positive. And again, like I think this is just the topic of subject for me the past week, especially with this post doing so well with Gen Alpha and Gen X and Gen Z and millennials, and everybody's looking generational. It's like it's never too late. Like just go for it. You know what I'm saying? Like what is it? What do you have to lose? You know what I mean? Like getting up in the morning, they always say you can choose to not be in a bad mood. You might get up on the wrong side of the bed, but then you have to go, you know what? Let me breathe. Let me meditate for a second. Things could be worse. I woke up. I'm here. Easier said than done, but we just have to stay positive, you know?
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.